This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1983, a little girl named Sabrina Bowie was found in a field in Red Springs, North Carolina. She was 11, and the brutal nature of the case horrified the town near Lumberton. Police quickly arrested 19-year-old Henry McCollum and his 15-year-old half-brother Leon Brown. They extracted confessions from both, and the men were convicted and put on death row, even though they recanted, saying their confessions were coerced. End of story? Not quite. In 2014, DNA pointed to a different killer. After 31 years in prison, the two men were exonerated. Henry and Leon were released. They received $750,000 each in reparations from the state, but even before the money was deposited, opportunists preyed on the brothers, and they again became victims of injustice. Here to update the investigative story is investigative journalist Joe Neff. He's been involved in the story for some time. He spent decades reporting for the News and Observer, now works for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering criminal justice system. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You should take us back to the original murder in 1983 and how Henry McCollum and Leon Brown became implicated.
Well, after Sabrina Bowie was found dead in a soybean field, the facts of the murder were really awful. She had been raped and she had been asphyxiated by someone shoving her underwear down her throat with a stick. It's a horrible crime. A young woman, a high school student, mentioned to police, oh, I think Henry McCollum is involved in this. And so the police went over, got Henry McCollum, took him down to the police station, and several hours later, they had a confession in hand. Meanwhile, half-brother Leon Brown and their mother went down to the police station to find out what was going on, and a couple hours later, Leon had signed a confession. And it just went from there. After a couple days later, detectives went back to this girl who gave the initial tip and said, well, I didn't have any information about the murder that he was involved. He just rode his bike around town and looked at us kind of weird. And so there they are. They get up. They are tried by Joe Freeman Britt. At that time was the world's deadliest prosecutor, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. And they were both sentenced to death. Later, Leon, they both were retried. Henry returned to death row. Leon was left to the tender mercies of the general population in the regular prison system.
In the meantime, both had recanted their confessions and said they had been coerced. Am I right?
Correct. They said that they did not. They gave the confession that the police wrote down, and they just wanted to leave the police station that night.
And again, no material evidence connecting them at all to this case, a recanted confession. And what's interesting, too, about this, and you can correct any of that if that's wrong, Joe, but also the fact is that the police and had what could have been another suspect in their midst who had committed a similar crime and lived not far away.
Correct. One thing that not enough attention is paid to this, but in their confessions, these brothers said that four people were involved. The other two guys had solid alibis. One was out of state. The other was not anywhere near the scene that day. So that in and of itself, the confessions were problematic. And secondly, there was a guy in town who has a history of sexual predation, was wanted for a very similar murder, a very similar modus operandi in to the Sabrina Bowie murder, across the state in Gaston County. And then a month after Henry and Leon are locked up, there's another woman raped and strangled in the tiny town of Red Springs, and they arrest this guy, Roscoe Artis. And he's convicted and put on death row before they try Henry and Leon. So they went ahead and tried Henry and Leon, and at that point they knew. The police had asked, sent various requests, fingerprint checks and all, that Roscoe Artis was a suspect in the case. Yet they went ahead and tried these two guys. And
they never revealed that the fact that they had held him as a suspect to defense attorneys or the court.
No, they did not reveal that. That came out through the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. Their investigation like 2012, 13.
And that's the investigation that ultimately led to their exoneration. Tell us what they found.
Well, they they found there was DNA on a cigarette butt from the crime scene that in the closing arguments, Joe Freeman Britt says that cigarette butt was left there by the killer. And they ran that through a database, the FBI CODIS database of anyone who's convicted of a felony across the country. Their DNA's in there, and bingo, Roscoe Artis comes up as a hit.
So they've got the wrong man, and ultimately they are exonerated, which has legal implications and also means that they're eligible for reparations, right?
Well, because their lawyers chose not to go through the Innocence Inquiry Commission because it was going to take the process would take a year or two. If they went directly to court in front of a judge, then they could get freedom very quickly. And it happened incredibly quickly, lightning speed in the North Carolina justice system, and they were out. The road bump was that they had to get a pardon of innocence from the governor to qualify for the innocence money. And a couple days after they were released, Henry and Land's lawyer filed the application. A couple days after that, the sitting district attorney in Robeson County, Johnson Britt, wrote an unprecedented letter. I've never seen anything like it, where the sitting prosecutor says, these two guys are innocent. They're the victims of police and prosecutorial misconduct. Governor, grant them a pardon. It took a long time, 9 months for them to get the pardon. Johnson Britt, the DA down there, told me that it was because the governor asked the SBI to investigate themselves in their handling of the case. The SBI were the lead investigators, and so here you have the prospect of the SBI investigating whether it committed misconduct. So it took 9 months for them to get the pardon.
Meanwhile, the brothers are out. They need money, and this money is being held up in this process.
They need money. They each walked out of prison with $45 in cash. They are not employable. Their sister did not have a job who they're living with. Their lawyers were holding bake sales and parties and passing the hat and raised about $14,000 or $15,000 to help pay for rent and utilities. But they were having a hard time. And at one point, these two activists, one in Atlanta, one in Brooklyn, heard about the case and called up the sister of the two brothers. And they, the advocates, were able to sign a contract with these guys, which gave them a guaranteed a cut of whatever money came along, and both from loans are from exoneration money or lawsuits, and the two women went out and found some lawyers to take over the case.
Talking to investigative journalist Joe Neff today on the state of things. So what happens after this? So and this means that the attorney that had been with them for these 20 years or so, who had been doing this pro bono, is more or less off the case, and now there's new representation.
They kicked the pro bono attorney, Ken Rose, who is handling the pardon with the governor. And they also kicked out a team of lawyers who were preparing to file a civil rights lawsuit against the law enforcement agencies. The new attorneys came in, took over the case, and immediately Henry and Leon took out $100,000 loans at the behest of the advocates and the lawyer. The loans had a huge fee, $5,000, totally violates North Carolina lending laws, and it had an annual interest rate of 42%. And out of the capital of that loan, of that $100,000, each of these advocates who brought the case to the lawyers, each of these advocates took $10,000 out of each loan. And they hadn't even come to North Carolina or met these two guys.
And there are the attorney. And so tell us who the attorney, because there are also two advocates involved in this. So let's name them.
Okay. The advocates are Kimberly Weeks from Atlanta and Deborah Pointer from Brooklyn. The attorney is Patrick McGarrow from Orlando, Florida. The next thing that is suspect in this case is that the work on the pardon was done when he entered the case. The application was filed. Johnson Britt wrote his letter that was instrumental in this. And the governor in June of 2015 pardoned these guys. To get the money, you have to do two things. You fill out a two-page form, the EC-100 form from the North Carolina Industrial Commission. You or I could fill it out within 10 minutes. And you attach a copy of the original murder conviction and a copy of the governor's pardon of innocence. You drop it off at the Industrial Commission. Bingo, you get your money that you're entitled to. The lawyer in this case, when the money came through, $750,000 for each guy, took a third of it. He said as a contingency fee, although he had done no work on the pardon. And in fact, the lawyer who is filing the civil lawsuits for these guys, who was kicked off the case, told me that in his contract with Henry and Leon, he would not take a penny of their $750,000. But so the lawyer takes a third of each. The brothers have to pay back these usurious $100,000 loans. And at the end of the day, they each come with about $360,000, less than half of what the state paid them.
Well, I'm talking to Joe Neff. We're going to take a break right here and continue this conversation with Joe Neff, who's an investigative journalist with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering criminal justice system. Our conversation will continue in a moment on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking to Joe Neff, investigative reporter with the Marshall Project, about what happened to Henry McCollum and Leon Brown. They were wrongly convicted of a murder in 1983, spent 31 years in jail, were finally exonerated, received reparations from the state of $750,000, and then got rid of the pro bono attorney who had worked with them that whole time, hired another attorney and two so-called advocates. And we haven't even talked about their sister yet. And essentially, Joe, we're talking about the fact that after all of that ordeal, wrongly convicted of a horrible crime, 31 years in jail, finally received reparations, and then were bilked out of that. So I guess we left the story with his attorney, who had written, first of all, a contract that guaranteed him a third of the reparations, obligates the brothers to a $100,000 loan at something over 40% interest, and then the counselors, who we haven't even talked about their role and how they received money in this.
Well, what happened is that after the attorney pocketed, as I said, a third of the state money, had to repay these usurious loans, and Henry McCollum, the older brother, within 7 months was flat broke and back to the finance company taking out loans, this time at 38% annual interest. So the question is, what happened to all that money? We know that a third went to the lawyer, some went to the finance company. Basically, Henry, both of these brothers are mentally disabled. They have both been found in court to be legally incompetent and cannot manage their own financial affairs. And they were just set upon, both by family, by friends. You know, I looked up the DMV records, and his sister has, you know, four cars registered to her now that that she acquired during this time period. It's basically a case of someone who, you know, can't even. Henry is such a sweet guy. He's got a yearning to be independent. He's very outspoken, but he bought a BMW and he's failed the driver's license test repeatedly. And so to think that he's able to manage on his own $750,000 is frightening.
What's going to happen to the people involved in this case? The lawyer, for instance.
Well, the main lawyer has been removed from Henry's as Henry's lawyer. A federal judge, Terrence Boyle, appointed a guardian ad litem to review the case. The federal judge has now ruled that Henry is incompetent. The guardian ad litem has appointed a real guardian to take over Henry's finances and to protect them, and has also brought in a new legal team. And the good thing for Henry is that this new legal team is a powerhouse D.C. law firm where John Roberts, our chief justice, used to practice. They're going to do this entire case pro bono for free and pay all the expenses. So that in and of itself, you're not paying a third in expenses of any settlement to a law firm. So Leon Brown still, Patrick Magaro, the lawyer from Florida, is still the attorney of record for Leon Brown. But we'll see how long that stays.
And there is, at least the state bar in North Carolina is investigating Magaro.
The state bar has an open investigation of Patrick Magaro, where his law license may very well be at stake.
Joe, thank you for your work. Joe Neff, investigative journalist with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the criminal justice system. Thank you so much for being with us.